Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. My guests today are Marcia Weissman and Elizabeth Cohen. Marcia is a senior policy fellow and former executive director of the Center for Community Alternatives, with offices in Syracuse and New York City. Elizabeth is a professor of political science at Syracuse University's Maxwell School of Citizenship and Public Affairs, and her new book is titled The Political Value of Time. Elizabeth, Marcia, welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks.
Well, we're here to discuss voting rights for people in the criminal justice system, both from the perspective of the recent executive order by Governor Andrew Cuomo and the issue more generally. So let me just start with my understanding of the basic facts about this executive order, which is the catalyst for the discussion. Here's my understanding. In April, Governor Andrew Cuomo announced that he would use an executive order to restore voting rights to ex-felons who were on parole. And in New York, ex-felons automatically get their voting rights back when they complete their parole, but not before that time. After that announcement by the governor, there was a piece published in Justice Today by Victoria Law that contended that the wording of the executive order is not that there will be a blanket restoration of voting rights to all 35,000 ex-felons on parole in New York State, but that they will be eligible for a review by the governor's office to restore their voting rights. And one speculation about that wording is that it's there to avoid what happened to Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe when he issued an executive order to restore voting rights to ex-felons that was subsequently overturned by the state's Supreme Court. So, if that reading is correct on my part, Marcia, let me start with you. How many felons who are on parole do you think will likely get their voting rights restored through this executive order?
At this point, it's too early to predict how many formerly incarcerated people on parole will get their voting rights restored. I would say one thing, that even at this moment, it is possible for a formerly incarcerated person on parole to get their voting rights restored by applying for and receiving something called a certificate of rehabilitation or certificate of good conduct. So, in fact, there are some formerly incarcerated people who can vote, even if they're on parole. But this will obviously open the doors and make it seemingly much easier for it to happen than to go through the application process for a certificate. I think it's too soon to tell how many people will actually be approved. I would like to believe that the governor's sort of qualification on restoration is based solely on wanting to protect it and not wanting to make it blanket. But in the reality, he will, in fact, grant voting rights to anyone who is on parole. I would not understand a reason to distinguish between one person or another.
Yeah, I'm going to get into some of the arguments about that more generally in a minute. Elizabeth, you write a lot about different limitations on citizenship and inclusion. How significant to you, or potentially significant, is this change that the governor has put forward?
Well, anytime we're reducing the amount of time that a large portion of the population has been removed from exercising the franchise, it's significant. I think if you look at kind of the history of important elections since 2000, we can see that sometimes these things matter
a
lot. Yeah, these things can really matter a lot, and that's also one of the reasons that people resist these types of changes, because they believe that it's pandering, or that the votes will go to people who are involved in restoring the vote. But you know, we're a democracy, and the more people that vote, generally, the more legitimate the democracy is.
I want to come back to some of those political considerations in a minute, but let me expand this conversation then from specifically the governor's executive order to a more general discussion about thinking about the voting rights for people involved in the criminal justice system. States vary across the country in terms of how inclusive or exclusive they are regarding this issue. And just to take the two ends of the spectrum, on the most inclusive end, you have Vermont and Maine, which allow people to vote even while they're incarcerated, even while they're in prison. And then other states, such as Alabama and Mississippi, bar certain kinds of felons from voting for life, period. So in New York, and we got into this a little bit just a second ago, but in New York, once a convicted person completes their parole, their voting rights are restored. So if they go through the parole, then that becomes automatic. But those who have been convicted and are on parole, as you point out, Marcia, they had this path toward voting rights, toward that being restored, but it was a complicated one. So this simplifies it and, as you said, opens the door. And then people who are incarcerated cannot vote while they are incarcerated in New York State. So
can I make one
addition
one important?
Yeah, absolutely.
People who are have been convicted and serving a sentence can't vote, but if you're detained – right, prior to conviction, like folks in the Justice Center can vote.
Okay.
They can vote by absentee ballot.
Okay. And I imagine they're going to need some help to do that, given
Absolutely.
That they're incarcerated.
Yes.
So Elizabeth, let me come back to you. And from the standpoint of thinking about democracy and citizenship, you made the argument very briefly there that, you know, we are a democracy. More citizens should be voting. But let's turn it around. What is the argument that you think, the most valid argument that you would make for barring ex-felons from voting? And then we can get into speculating about what some of the real political motivations are. But let's take this from a more theoretical perspective. Make an argument for ex-felons not voting.
Sure. I think the standard argument that's offered in support of the idea that even ex-felons shouldn't vote is that these are people who've broken the social contract, and when you break the social contract, you lose the trust of the citizenry and in some ways disqualify yourself from participating in political decision-making. It's probably a better argument for people who are still serving time than for people who've served their sentence and paid their debt to society, but it is sometimes applied to people as kind of a permanent civil disability that follows them along with a few other disabilities that follow them after they've served their sentence.
Well, it is curious, Marcia, that given what Elizabeth just said, that we have this idea of rehabilitation, supposedly, that happens in prison or because you've served a sentence. And then you're out, you've completed your parole, but somehow this one piece of citizenship, voting, you don't get back. I mean, talk about that a little bit.
I think there's a huge contradiction between the rhetoric about what criminal justice system involvement is and what incarceration is in terms of rehabilitation and the reality that people face. The collateral consequences of a conviction don't just attach to voting. So there are many other rights that people lose through formal legal regulations and laws, and many more that they lose just through informal practices. And I think at the end of the day, the question of disenfranchisement of people convicted of crimes goes to the heart of who the people are, i.e. predominantly poor, Black, Latino, people of color, the purpose of disenfranchisement, which is, I think, a very political purpose, and the long legacy of racism in this country that essentially defines people of color, particularly Black people, as something less than human. So the human right to vote doesn't apply, if you will, to a population that has been excluded historically and at this moment, even though we've had to find new mechanisms for that exclusion.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Elizabeth Cohen of Syracuse University and Marcia Weissman from the Center for Community Alternatives. Elizabeth, what's your take on what Marcia just said? Does that sound about right to you? Are there things that you'd add to it?
Yeah, I think that it's really important to take note of the history of felon disenfranchisement laws, which really date back to the period of time following the Civil War during the institution of Jim Crow, when states were looking for ways to eliminate newly enfranchised African-American citizens from their voting rolls. And you can go back and look at state by state at the discussions that the legislatures had about both defining, you know, what constituted a felony and then what the consequences would be. And you can very clearly, very explicitly see that these were racialized discussions, and New York State is no exception. These rules were put into place to keep the voting population white, and they've worked.
And I was thinking about that when I was looking at the states that were on either end of this axis and kind of making some guesses in my head about the populations that would be involved. But Vermont and Maine on one end, letting people vote while they're in prison. Well, I'm betting that that prison population is probably whiter than the one in New York or California or Texas. And then Alabama and Mississippi, I'm thinking those are very conservative states, and that prison population is probably likely pretty heavily not white. And so it seems like that kind of fits the dynamic that you're talking about historically.
Right. And one of the reasons I think that Governor Cuomo sort of was forced to go the route of an executive order is how those racialized politics play out in New York. Because there has been legislation proposed to restore voting rights, and it's been defeated by the legislature, and it breaks down by party lines and by geographical regional lines. So the opposition comes from the Senate, which and the Senate upstate senators who are predominantly white.
Well, let me push on this a little further. So there's two things that may be related, but maybe need to be separated out. In terms of what's driving this in a real politic kind of way, one of the things I'm hearing is party politics. And I think, Elizabeth, you mentioned this at the outset, the sense of who would these folks be voting for if they were allowed to vote? And then whose interests are going to be helped or hurt by that? And it seems like, you know, there's a sort of a conservative-liberal divide, maybe Democratic-Republican divide. On that, Marcia, you just mentioned that the efforts in New York State break down in the state Senate, controlled by Republicans at least up until perhaps soon. Then you have this race component that you've both been talking about driving this as well. Can either of you kind of either link those two or parse them out in some way so that there's a clear understanding on my part of what's driving it?
I mean, I think one thing to pay attention to is the fact that even, you know, you mentioned this split, this party politics split, but even for Democrats, it's almost always the case that if you're running for office, running as someone who has been tough on crime and criminals is a winner. And so it really takes a lot of guts and maybe some security, too, to try and push back against that incentive to victimize people who have already experienced consequences for their actions.
One of the things that pops in my mind when you said that was the pattern of governors who, you know, governors often are the ones that are running for president and have the best shot at becoming president, and even Democratic governors kind of burnishing their credentials in that regard by denying pleas for clemency and stays of execution and other kinds of things prior to when they're getting ready to run.
Yeah, I keep thinking back to the Clintons and the super predator and the way all the ways in which he strove to show that he'd been really, you know, really not just responsible, but hard on criminals.
You're listening to The Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Marcia Weissman from the Center for Community Alternatives and Professor Elizabeth Cohen from Syracuse University. Elizabeth, you wanted to make a point about a dynamic in New York State, which you think adds to the complexity of this and maybe drives some of the politics. Tell us what that is.
Yeah, so if you're looking at the larger issue of whether or not people who've been convicted of crimes and are incarcerated get to vote, one thing that a lot of people don't realize and you need to understand the electoral politics is for the purposes of apportionment, so representation in Congress, people who are incarcerated count in the location where they are incarcerated. So if you're, for example, in perhaps a not densely populated area of upstate New York, but there's a facility, a correctional facility there, all those bodies count for the purposes of apportionment, and because they are prevented from voting, they don't get to have a say in the making of the laws. And so it's a real kind of double loss for people who are incarcerated, but almost a scam, right? It's a double win for people in those areas. And so they have a lot of incentive to keep things the way they are, preventing people who are serving time from voting.
And Marcia, you've done work on sort of the broader impacts of these limitations and lack of rights. Pivot off of what Elizabeth said and tell us some of those things.
So the disenfranchisement of the person on parole does not just affect that person. It affects the family and the community. It affects the family by sort of a sense of solidarity with the person who can't vote. So if you have someone in your family who can't vote, particularly a parent, the other adults in the family also may not vote so as to not embarrass the person who's disenfranchised. Or in general, just to show sort of a collective disdain for voting. Yeah. Like if he can't vote, why should I? Why should I even care? And then it has this broader community effect, particularly when you're looking at elections that are driven by districts, right? So in certain communities, like I would guess that if you look at the south side of Syracuse, a community that's been horrifically over-policed, where African-American men have been locked up for offenses that white men would never be locked up for, I would guess that upward of 60-70% of men in that community are disenfranchised. Mm-hmm. So you're having a huge effect on who can run and ultimately who gets elected.
So on that point, then, can either of you give me a sense, thinking of the nation as a whole, of the scale of ex-felons not voting? I mean, how many people are we talking about across the nation that cannot vote because of this? Any ideas?
I think over 6 million people.
That's the figure that I've heard. And I know that, of course, where they are or where they're from varies widely, so that there are some districts for which this has just an immense impact, where 50% or more of the population can't vote. And just to add to the point that you were making, let's not forget that when people can't or are strongly discouraged and end up not voting, who's representing their kids? Mm-hmm. You know, that means populations of children have nobody speaking up for them because they can't vote. And so there are lots of downstream consequences in addition to just any specific election or person's point of view not being represented.
Are either of you aware of any studies that have been done that have tried to tease out for ex-felons who have had their voting rights restored, what the percentage of them that votes, what's their turnout rate, so to speak? Do we have any information on that?
It's actually really hard to tease that out on a broad scale because the different procedures for reinstating the vote vary so widely. In some places, they're intentionally quite complicated or require kind of petitions. I mean, I think that was actually the case in Virginia for a long time and was a problem, that the petitioning process to the governor was so complicated that lots of people failed or just were so daunted that they didn't try. So it really varies widely.
And in general, people don't know what their rights are. And they are under the impression, for example, people on probation who never lose the right to vote in New York State in any event, they don't understand that. They don't know that. They're not aware of that. People, once they're off parole, may not be aware of that. And at least in New York State, there are a number of campaigns by advocacy groups, often groups led by directly impacted people, to do voter education and voter registration. I know in CCA's office, CCA does that. We have signs up. We have forms so people can register. But there has to be a proactive effort to bring people into sort of the voting booth who actually can vote.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to The Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guests are Elizabeth Cohen of Syracuse University and Marcia Weissman from the Center for Community Alternatives. All right, let's go back now to the governor's executive order and think about some of the politics of this for a minute. And in particular, I want to ask you a question about the timing of this executive order. Do we have Cynthia Nixon to thank for this? If we think this executive order is a good thing, both of you are smiling and not looking like you want to say anything.
There's been a general pattern we've seen of her taking strong stands and that it not taking that much to push our governor a little bit to take action on some of these social justice issues. I think it would be harder to draw a more direct causal connection than that, though. I
totally agree with that. But I would also point out that the drumbeat for restoring voting rights and removing collateral consequences has been fairly relentless and, again, led by directly impacted people. There are now organizations in New York State and nationally made up, led by people who were incarcerated, who speak up vigorously and at every opportunity about restoring the right to vote. So perhaps the message became clearer once Cynthia Nixon came into office, but I mean came into the primary. But I think it's more than that.
And what? How do you think this is going to play out? I mean, Andrew Cuomo clearly is thinking about the national political stage. I mean, he's thinking about the presidency. Whether he runs or not, we don't know. But he certainly is something that's been being considered. So how is this going to play out, do you think, for the governor on the national stage as a potential presidential candidate? Will it matter? Will it help him? Will it hurt him? What's your take on that?
I think there's a lot of evidence that the Democrats are that the Democrats have been neglecting groups that might be really strong supporters, and we've seen this in some of the special elections that have gone in surprising ways that Democrats mobilized voters that they'd been neglecting for a while in states they'd been neglecting for a while, and one of the things that the party will be required to do if it wants to follow up on that is take some tough stances and do things like back away from the more punitive version of enfranchisement rules. It would be a huge boon to Democrats if we were able to get a substantial proportion, let's not say all, people who've been convicted of felonies on the voting rolls and voting. But even, you know, we know in tight elections it's made a difference. And, of course, it would prevent one of the sources of disenfranchisement that we know is happening, which is purging people who are vulnerable from voting rolls when they actually do qualify to vote.
And I'm wondering about whether this is something that might be a two-pronged thing for the governor if he's thinking about president. One is it might help him in the primaries and burnish those credentials. But I'm thinking of a general election in 2020 and thinking about the election of 2016 and the way that race appeared to play a role in that. I'm just wondering, how would something like this play out if he's running against Donald Trump?
Well, I think that's an interesting question and complicated and linked to many other issues. But I would point out that at this moment, there is bipartisan support for criminal justice reform. It's not deep. It doesn't go far enough, in my view, but it's there. And criminal justice is not quite the hot-button issue that it was 10 or 15 years ago. We found other demons. And so I'm not sure that any Democrat running on a platform that might include reform and include voter enfranchisement would really suffer from that.
One thing to consider is that we're seeing some movement on kind of attitudes toward the criminal justice system as a flood of people is entering the system who are not racial minorities but white people involved in opioid-related crimes. And that may, you know, I don't know if this says good things or bad things, but that may sway some public opinion. More generally, I think the question, it comes down to whether you think the Democrats need to be wooing Trump voters who had been Obama voters. You know, I think we think that's like 9%. Or whether Democrats need to be doing more mobilization of their base. And if you believe the latter, then it's not as much of a disadvantage in a national election to have been in support of enfranchising ex-felons or even felons.
We've only got really less than a minute left, but I wanted to try to squeeze this last thing in. Elizabeth, you mentioned something about purging people from the voter rolls. Could you just tick off in sort of a bullet point for me, what are some of the other significant denials of voting for citizens that we ought to be thinking about in this country?
Sure. Well, in addition to people who were purged from the rolls, we know that we need to be thinking about voter ID, for example, and the high bar that voter ID rules are putting up in some states. And then, you know, we've been following, or some of us have been following what Kris Kobach has been up to in terms of a wide variety of restrictions that keep people off the voting rolls. In some districts, really substantial numbers of people. And it looks like ultimately he was not able to defend that position at all. It was truly appalling how little evidence there was to show that that these rules had been put into place to prevent voter fraud.
Well, that's all we have time for. That's another program, and we should have that in the coming months. That was Elizabeth Cohen and Marcia Weissman. And again, Elizabeth, Marcia, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.